This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
It wasn't that long ago that scientists unlocked the human genome. Now, your unique genetic sequence can be mapped, paving the way for personalized healthcare and perhaps some high-tech identity theft.
In some instances, they actually could come up with the exact identity of who that sequence really belonged to just based on this information.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear about the challenges of maintaining privacy in the information age. We'll also visit a school in the Northeast that's been getting along quite well without a principal. And we'll spend an academic minute making you want to scream. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Science says that no one besides yourself has ever been born or ever will be again with your precise DNA sequence, unless you're an identical twin, and even then maybe not so much. So a complete DNA sequence precisely identifies a person. And a recent paper has shown that a real breach of privacy is feasible with access to limited genomic data, bare-bones demographic information, and publicly available internet tools. Here to help us take a look at the risks and non-risks of genetic testing on your privacy is Dr. Bruce Korf, a medical geneticist and chair of the Department of Genetics at the University of Alabama in Birmingham. Dr. Korf, what's going on here? How can the identity of a person who has his genome sequence be discovered?
What was done here is the group began with some publicly available genome sequences. There have been some people who, with appropriate permission, had agreed to put their genome sequences into a place where others can see them. They then used that to reconstruct some sequence patterns on the Y chromosome. So that means they were using sequences from males. And there are a certain number of Y chromosome sequences that have been inherited as blocks of DNA through human evolution. And there are several such blocks that distinguish different groups of individuals that migrated to different parts of the world over the course of human history. They could figure out from the sequence which particular blocks of Y chromosome DNA these various males who had been sequenced had. And then they went to a database that exists of Y chromosome sequences that are attached to surnames, because at least in Western societies, the surname, the last name, tends most of the time to be inherited, you might say, from the father. These surnames tend to travel with the Y chromosome, in effect. And these databases have been used by people as kind of a way to track ancestry. Somebody will put their Y chromosome sequences in or get those tested. Their names are known, and their hope is that they'll get linked to other people who share those same sequences who may be distant relatives potentially. So there's a fair amount of data now on these Y chromosome sequences and the corresponding last names. So when they put these publicly available Y sequences into the database, they could figure out, in some cases, what the last names might be. Now, in some of those, the last names were not unique, and so they really couldn't come up with much. And in some cases, the last names could have been very, very common, like Smith, for example, and that doesn't narrow things down too much. But in a handful of cases, they actually found last names that were fairly unique and correlated well with the Y chromosome sequence. And then in many of these cases, very, very general information was available, like year of birth and the city where the individual resides. And in a handful of cases, they could actually take the last name, the year of birth, and the city and narrow it down to one or to very few people. So in some instances, they actually could come up with the exact identity of who that sequence really belonged to just based on this information. So that's really what was done here.
Well, does the risk of breach of privacy apply to anyone who has genetic testing performed?
So no, it does not, certainly not at this point in time. When genetic testing is done these days, it is usually done in a very targeted way. One has a particular clinical question in mind, and the way to answer that question is to determine the sequence of a particular gene of the 22,000 or so. And so you're not looking at all the Y chromosome sequences that this group looked at. You're really just taking a very, very tiny chunk of the genome. Now we are beginning to use what is called exome sequencing. And so that means to look at the 1.2 or so percent of the genome that actually directs the synthesis of proteins. And it does make it possible to do a genetic test without a prior knowledge of what particular gene you might be interested in. But even that does not target the Y chromosome sequences that were used in this study. In some cases now, and probably more and more in the time to come, the potential for doing the whole genome, which then would include the Y chromosome, does exist. So, of course, theoretically, if that all happened, you could do the same thing. Of course, the other point to realize is that most people, when they do genetic testing, are not putting their genome data into the public domain. It exists inside of clinical laboratories that have strict privacy rules about the sharing of any of the information. So even if you had your whole Y chromosome sequence determined as part of a clinical test, it would not be sitting there open to the public for anybody to query your identity with. So in short, no, I don't believe that these risks apply to those that have clinical genetic testing.
What are some of the potential risks of having someone's identity revealed following genome sequencing?
Well, the first point may be to state what the risks are not, because I guess it's important to remember that there are privacy laws in place and these offer significant protection. So, for example, the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act would prohibit the use of genetic information, including genetic testing, gene sequence, actually even things like family history, prohibits the use from being incorporated into employment decisions or health insurance decisions. So that means eligibility for health insurance or the setting of rates or anything. So those are off the table as risks. There could be risks of having your identity known in terms of things like life or disability insurance that are not covered under GINA, life insurance in particular. I suppose it's possible if a life insurance company figured out who you were from doing this, that they could, in principle at least, use that information to make a decision. And I don't think there's any law right now that would prohibit that. You know, so in general terms, what are the risks? They're probably, I mean, if it were the case that you're genome sequence really was in the public domain and somebody traced it back to you, the risks would probably be tangible ones of life insurance discrimination, I guess, and potentially stigmatization. Somebody could decide that you're at risk for something. They might or might not be interpreting the data correctly, but you wouldn't have much control over that. And so it could theoretically be used to sort of invade your privacy in one way or another. I think the whole issue hinges on how widely you're willing to make your sequence information available if you're concerned about those kinds of risks. But again, the risks are there, definitely, but there are many protections that need to be kept in mind as well.
Well, knowing what we now know about genomic privacy, or lack of it, will this interfere with future genomic sequencing research?
Certainly there is the potential that this could highlight the potential risks and discourage some people from wanting to participate. Obviously, I hope that does not happen, and I think there are good reasons to believe that the risks remain very low in this context, and that's true for several reasons. One is most of the genomic sequencing research does not involve putting raw sequence data in the public domain where anybody can access it. You know, the instances that were used in this paper are somewhat special instances where that's been for whatever reason, sometimes because of the actual expressed desire of the participant, sometimes because of the nature of the study. But it's not typical to put all of this information right out there where anybody can see it. So there should be and are safeguards put in place to ensure the privacy of individuals who participate actually in pretty much any kind of research, and this would be no exception. So I think people should realize that this was a special case and is not the general case. So that's point number one. I do think it does highlight the importance of reading the informed consent forms and asking questions and making sure one understands what potential risks there could be. This is actually already in consent forms in most cases, I think, that there could be potential risks of breach of privacy because no system is perfect, but here are the safeguards that are being taken to protect against that. And it's important for people to understand that these are not empty words, but yes, there are potential risks, but yes, also there are safeguards in place to try to mitigate them. So if the outcome of this is that people are more alert and they are willing and interested in participating, but with full cognizance of what they're signing into, I don't think that's a bad thing. But I certainly would not want to see the outcome be a kind of a panic that all of a sudden they're signing away their privacy forever, because that really is not the case. And I think people should realize that even here in this study, with the exception of very high profile, very well-known instances of sequencing, which therefore revealed nothing that wasn't already known, the actual true identities were not made public. They were just known to the investigators. So I really think people should be reassured as much as anything.
Well, finally, Doctor, let's look ahead. What should be done to better protect the privacy of individuals who have their genomes sequenced?
Well, I think the first point is to be clear and open about the potential risks and, at the same time, the safeguards that have been put in place. So it does highlight the importance of the informed consent procedure and for people to realize that, you know, they're engaging in an activity that's not free of risk. And I don't think anybody would want people to believe that research is totally risk-free. I think it does highlight also to me the importance of there being a partnership between the researcher and the participant. This is not a one-way street where the participant agrees to give some blood or DNA and then the investigator goes off and does what they're going to do with it, and that's the end of their discussion. I do think that there is a reasonable expectation of the participant to be kept in the loop on progress in the research, not necessarily given their own personal results. That may or may not be relevant to the reason for the research, and I don't think you want people in a situation where they're expecting information to use to guide their own personal health decisions when the work is really not validated in that way. But I think it's fair for them to know in general terms what's been learned and to be kind of respected as a participant where there is some feedback as to how valuable the participation was and the kinds of insights that resulted from it. So keeping people informed and keeping them engaged, I think, is a good thing. And knowing that people are facing some potential risks, they need to feel that they have confidence in the people that they're working with. And I believe that comes from perceiving the research activity as a partnership rather than simply as a encounter that comes and goes. So I think in the end, this is really not anything really but healthy to have a clear idea of what the potential risks are. It's not a trivial undertaking, by the way, to obtain this kind of personal information. And so it's not a thing that is highly likely to occur in many cases. But people need to go into research with their eyes open. And if this helps open eyes and creates a better dialogue with the investigators, I think in the long run, it'll be as much a good thing as anything else.
Dr. Bruce Korf is a medical geneticist and chair of the Department of Genetics at the University of Alabama in Birmingham. His paper titled Genetic Privacy in the Information Age appeared in the August 2013 issue of the journal Clinical Chemistry. Still to come, there's a school in Maine where you can never be sent to the principal's office. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Thank you. Got any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for the best of our knowledge, number 1219. This is the best of our knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. The Recce School in Portland, Maine is a pretty unusual school. Besides not having traditional walls or doors to classrooms, it recently became the first public elementary school to go from a traditional principal-led school to a teacher-led school. Although many were against the idea at first, teachers, parents, and administrators have embraced the model through a lot of hard work and dedication. Salt Radio's Emily Chin tells us about it.
Recce isn't your typical public elementary school. For one thing, there aren't any classrooms with regular walls and doors. Instead, class spaces look like giant cubicles divided by tan partitions that are about 5 or 6 feet tall. As you walk around, you can see kids in one space reading a story and hear a math lesson going on in another. At first, this all seems really noisy.
Once you've been here for a couple of months, you get it as an educator.
That's Kevin Brewster. He teaches kindergarten.
It really breeds a sense of collegiality. There's sharing of ideas. You hear a good song over the wall, you're asking that teacher, they're sharing it. You hear a great lesson, you're going to find out.
The sense of community has existed at the school since it opened in the 70s, but the need to support each other now is more important than it ever has been. This year, Recce officially became a teacher-led school. That means the school is completely run by teachers, and there's no principal at all.
Do you have your first bus, kids?
The bus schedule has just changed, so Kevin is making sure that everyone gets to the right place. Kevin is one of the new teacher leaders at Recce. There are two of them, and each of them spends half their day in the classroom and half their day on the daily tasks that a principal would normally do, things like meeting with parents, communicating with district administrators, or disciplining students. The rest of the principal's job is taken care of by four different committees made up of teachers and staff. They address internal matters of the school, like staff development and curriculum changes. And every teacher at Recce is on a committee.
There's a lot of legwork that goes into that, a lot of delegating, a lot of communicating, making sure that people are on the same page, but it's dispersed.
The philosophy behind a teacher-led school is to put the ultimate decision-making power with those who know the students best, the teachers. So when Recce's principal left 2 years ago, they wanted to make sure that the ethos of the school stayed consistent. They felt that changing to a teacher-led model would guarantee that consistency rather than bringing in an outsider. But some people weren't ready to completely eliminate the administration, like Jean Swanton, a first-grade parent.
I was concerned that without having a principal, we might be overlooked. A great principal knows the district, knows how to get things done, and I was afraid we might be losing that.
Recce researched other schools for a year and came up with the two-teacher-leader, four-committee model that they felt would best serve the school and fit with the district. The teachers and staff voted 42-15 to go forward with that plan. Deb Drake was one of the 15 who voted against it because she didn't think having two leaders would actually work. But she has since changed her mind.
You know, you have that situation where mom and dad, and one says something to mom and the other one says something to dad, and they're playing against each other. Well, they don't play against each other, so that's why it works.
Communication is now vital at Recce. It is only the third month of school, but so far, things have gone pretty well. It does require a lot of effort. Allison Villani teaches art at Recce.
I've definitely gone to a lot more meetings than I've ever gone to in my entire life.
How is that for you?
I'm not a meeting person.
The amount of energy and coordination it takes to run the school has certainly increased. There is a little bit of a concern about teachers burning out, but the benefits of the new model have been noticeable. Even with so many committees and so many meetings, Chris Keegan, one of the other teacher leaders, says that the system has actually cut through a lot of bureaucracy. Decisions are made faster. The committees have the power to make changes on their own, and they don't have to clear them with an administrator who might not know the situation as well. Kevin Brewster.
What's happened, I think, is the rest of the staff has been empowered to step up and help solve problems. It's truly a teacher-led school, not just with two lead teachers.
Nationally, there's a debate about how to increase teacher accountability. At Reiki, the teachers are truly accountable for their work, so this model may seem like a solution for that. But Kevin points out that this probably wouldn't work everywhere.
In a traditional school, you close your door and you're sealed in. You're an island unto yourself. Here, there are no doors. The doors are always open. And that's physically true, but it's also metaphysically true. It's an open community.
Okay, take one more breath. Get a little taller, a little higher in the hips. And then everybody lower it all the way down.
A new day begins at Reiki, and Kevin is on a yoga mat in his socks as his kindergartners learn yoga.
Does it feel good?
This afternoon, he'll be answering parent emails on an iPad between monitoring recess and going to a committee meeting. It'll be a busy day as always, but for now, he has just a little bit of time to breathe. For SALT Radio, I'm Emily Chin.
Sometimes you just want to scream. And that's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. From laughs to sighs, humans are adept at communicating with a number of nonverbal sounds. And as Harold Gazulis, professor of psychology at Emory University, explains, nothing grabs our attention quite like a scream.
Many animal species are known to scream, and these vocalizations most likely first evolved as a way to startle an attacking predator and provide a chance to escape. In some social animals, screams are also a means to recruit help when in trouble with members of your own species. Our earlier research on several species of monkeys, for example, revealed that an attacked individual's screams recruit assistance from its kin and allies. These loud and distinctive vocalizations provide information about the victim's situation to its supporters, even when they are some distance away. Curiously, there has been little formal study of human screams, so our current research is addressing some preliminary questions. We know that people scream in a variety of contexts. Do we use different kinds of screams in different situations, and can we discriminate those screams and interpret them? In our studies, we present different types of screams to study participants via a computer program and headphones, and then have them respond to a series of questions about what they hear. The results show that participants are good at discriminating the specific emotional state of the screamer, for example, whether they are excited and happy or fearful, or whether they are experiencing pain or are annoyed or being aggressive. Females are better than males at these tasks, as are those participants who score high on measures of empathy. Participants are also very good at identifying whether a pair of screams is from the same individual or two different individuals. This is a critical part of being able to recognize the identity of a screamer. I think screams are inherently interesting vocalizations, but there are also potential human health applications of research on screams because there are multiple psychiatric disorders that involve screaming behavior.
That was Harold Gazulis of Emory University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.